This podcast was recorded and produced in the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. We pay respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land. We acknowledge the First Nations people who fought and continue to fight police violence and colonial violence. This podcast is only possible because of the continued resistance and leadership of Aboriginal communities. This episode contains descriptions of police violence and racial profiling. Please take care while listening.
And then I speak with people and folks are telling me that like they found out on the news that their neighbors didn't know until the next day and they were talking to them, you know, and then hearing from some people who were like, you know, I had to console my neighbor who started packing when she got this announcement. That is like world shattering. Now all of a sudden people are like, well, I don't know what's going to happen. And I won't have any sense of certainty because I don't know if I'm going to get a property that I want to live in. I don't know if I'm going to be near any of the people. Like, you know, my whole life has all of a sudden been thrown off kilter and I now can't see myself in the future in the same way.
On the 20th of September 2023, the then Premier of Victoria, Daniel Andrews, announced that all 44 public housing towers in Victoria would be demolished and redeveloped.
Our 44 high-rise towers are old, they are out of date, they are crumbling, they need to go.
These are the flats Musab, Ahmed, Reem, Daniel and I grew up in. Once again, these announcements were made without the community's consultation. Many residents found out on the news, the same as 3 years before when the hard lockdown happened. 6 days after this announcement, Daniel Andrews announced his resignation. This is the final episode of The People's Record. My name's Idil Ali. You've heard the stories of these flats, the basketball court, the case, the people's hearing, the lockdown, the promises. And now they want to knock it all down. The first buildings scheduled for demolition are the same buildings that were under hard lockdown. When the announcement came, although shocking, it felt like the next chapter.
When I speak to residents, when I'm with my friends and my family and these announcements were made, the first thing that came about was like seeing it as like a, seeing it in the long line of things that have occurred, you know, and really seeing it as a connection to like, oh, this is another attack on us, especially right after COVID-19. And it was like all of these things around the hard lockdown, around this wanting to repair and heal and throwing money at us that doesn't actually go to residents. It goes to organizations, not-for-profits, and the people who, I guess, keep us in line. And I just thought it was really interesting that people outside of our communities didn't see it in the same way. I wonder, doing research alongside residents, what are the things that you're hearing from residents?
Priya is a housing and anti-racism researcher at RMIT.
Yeah, well, just to touch on something you said before, talking about what I've heard from residents, it, like, obviously people in the communities have had this analysis, they've had a political analysis of the way that the state has treated them, the way that they've been discriminated against as public housing residents, but also like as majority African residents in, you know, a couple of these estates, North Melbourne, Flemington, Carlton. And so it's not like academics are coming up with some sort of novel theory of what is happening. Like, obviously, as you said, it's folks that live there that know what's been happening most intimately and have, you know, felt these services either pull away if they were provided beforehand or just like not exist. And so talking to people in the towers, yeah, it was just incredibly impactful hearing about the texture and the richness of people's lives and their interconnectedness in the communities that they were in. And I got to speak with folks that were at the Flemington estate and also in North Melbourne. And there's something, I think, special that happens when you spend so much time in a particular area. There's like a density of feeling and relationships that build up in that place that I don't know if the state can see it. I don't know if they understand.
At a community meeting at the local mosque shortly after the announcement, Priya remembers what someone said.
I think there's a very keen awareness among the population that there is a large proportion of Horn of Africa communities, especially in Flemington, North Melbourne, and Carlton. I think Flemington has the highest proportion of African residents that are like out of those estates. But there is also, you know, this diversity and inclusion language of multiculturalism and, you know, the Victorian government wanting to be like good to multicultural communities and engage in a nice way and be really friendly and have like a brown face or a black face on whatever kind of initiative that makes it really murky to talk in frank terms about racism and the way that it functions in our housing system. Because if we can't even talk about it in the way it functions in policing, it makes it so like that much more difficult to talk about it in relation to housing. And yet, you know, people have these assessments of their own living situations. Like, I remember going to one of the consultations, or actually I think it was a community meeting shortly after the announcement that the towers were going to be redeveloped, and someone was like, is it because we're black? Like,
yeah,
you know, like
I think so.
Yeah, it's the, you know, this country has always had a problem with anti-blackness and Islamophobia, mm-hmm. which I think is also part of the conversation here.
Earlier in the series, you heard Reem describe what it's like to grow up in the flats. The massive families, the summer nights, the worlds she made downstairs.
I think living in the flats was like, growing up there, like my childhood was like awesome. Like I really like, I'm actually saddens me that like my future, like future generations won't maybe have that same experience, you know?
I know what Reem means. I grew up in the Carlton flats. And in the inner city, we learned that to be black was to be the city's favorite scapegoat. To be from the flats was to be under attack with no recourse. Having said that, I can't think of a place I felt more belonging. I don't even mean content, but actually confident. The strength I received from existing between Ligon and Drummond, Elgin and Alexander Parade carried me far beyond. We didn't wait for the state to tell us we were home. We decided it for ourselves. Ilo Diaz grew up in the Fitzroy Flats. We heard from him in episode one.
I always say, I'm from Chile, but I grew up in the flats. Why? Because I'm pointing to where I was born and where my cultural center is, Chile. But growing up in the flats was just as much as a cultural part of me than anything else. You know, and I feel like that is so unique in someone's upbringing, which is like where I spent my formative years as a kid growing up, what I saw every day, what you smell, the sounds upstairs, downstairs, the people you hang out with, like all of that is so formative. So my cultural center is like Chile and the flats, like the flats is, so when I see the flats, that's me. You know, like that's my identity. I root my identity to that. And so then when the government turns around and says, we're gonna destroy a piece of your identity, It's personal,
yeah.
You know, like it really shocks you to the core, and you have to, I have had to, like, I'm pre-mourning the day that the Fitzroy flats come down,
yeah.
The Carlton flats come down, because that's my cultural center as well,
yeah.
You know, and I think for so many generations of people, it's been that, and
true.
And it's like, it's an experience, it's a unique experience of like, I connect with you, Idil.
Yeah.
Why? Because we're both from the flats.
I got to hear from one older woman who talked about being able to feel a sense of independence after leaving an abusive relationship, and basically saying that this was her home and she'd put so much into it. It was a place that was safe for her, but also a place that could be safe for other people she could bring people into. And it was a site for her to be able to give and receive care. And she was like, if you want to bring the towers down, you're going to have to do it with me inside.
The state built these towers, then it policed us inside them. The towers were always an instrument not simply of shelter, but of control. We have been hyper-visible to the police, monitored, mapped, documented, and at the same time, invisible to the rest of the city. And then I had a moment of pause and I was like, nobody from school has ever been to my house. Nobody from school who doesn't live here has ever been to any of our houses. We go to each other's houses, but they don't come to our houses. We sometimes go to theirs, like later on in high school for a house party or a gathering, but there's like this invisible, you know? And there was a few like cool kids that could come like to the park under our buildings or whatever that we were like really tight with, but never upstairs, you know? And I remember reflecting on it years later and being like, oh wow, like when people were talking about prisons and they're like, you know, prisons is where we put undesirables, and
behind the doors, we just don't know what exists there. And I'm like, the buildings are like that. Like, nobody knows what the houses look like, what our homes look like. People we grew up with, we know our whole lives, don't know.
The state uses a very specific cycle. They enact violence, they refuse to apologize, they promise a new beginning, and then they do it all again. The Hail Michael case ended in a settlement. The 2020 lockdown ended with a promise of more consultation. Both times, the community were told things would be different, and yet the demolition announcement followed both.
Privatization of these estates, but also just the lack of embedded institutional learning in the government that keeps having to apologize to communities. You know, one would think that sorry means you don't do it again, but
in Australia,
I think this, yeah, in Australia, in this colony.
Sorry, I just thought about sorry. Day. No, like,
it's just like in this colony, I don't think so.
A lot of the media around social housing, I just think that they talk about this idea of being more housing for people, and they're trying to get the wider community to feel like, okay, well, that's going to be great for us renters, but they're not thinking about the fact that community housing is not public housing. Reduced public housing mean more strain on people looking, and it's going to only help people who own landlords. It's going to help landlords in real estate. And the government just doesn't want to be responsible for anything. We pay taxes only for it not to be beneficial to anybody, least of all ourselves. But I just think, like, when I think about, I think sometimes there's like optics that we have that we're not going in the right direction. I don't know how to say this. Like, I feel like the optics are, why won't the government do this, instead of the government's actually taking the small things that community has won over time. So like the reduction.
Yeah, they're winding back.
Yeah.
Social programs that were hard fought and won by people over time.
Yeah.
And then they're putting in place these really flimsy policies that sound really good, but in reality don't have, yeah, that, I think that's a really good example of that, is the social housing in comparison to government housing, and how a lot of people think that that's a really, I mean, it sounds really good when Labor make an announcement and say, we're investing all this into social housing, but I don't think people are picking up that slight point of difference in what they mean. I think they think what the government means is maybe government housing, and not so, they think, I think, I'm only surmising, but I think people think that, yeah, that they mean government housing.
Yeah.
But they don't mean that.
Yeah.
And social housing, I mean, like, I don't know, like, I haven't worked in housing for a really long time, but that's run by an organizations that are not government housing, and it's putting people still at the peril of landlords and their most basic needs at the hands of people that, but who are they? We don't even know. Like, I don't know. Yeah. What is the social housing sector?
Yeah. We're going to see in the next few years, aren't we?
That was Mariki Onus. We heard from her in the previous episode. She knows intimately what it's like to fight for home and land and what it is to build community.
The harm that these kinds of announcements cause, and not a harm that doesn't leave space for people to act with agency, but like a traumatic event, a damaging event like the lockdowns and then the announcement, is, it's world-shaking. I think in housing research, we talk a lot about the way that home provides you with a sense of ontological security, and it's like your ability to locate yourself in the world is so contingent on this idea of home and your relationship to it. And when you think about people from community who've had to escape war, who've had to escape, you know, genocides, who've had to escape extreme situations of duress, have had to seek political asylum, and then bring family members over when they can support them, to be able to then try and build a home in a place where they don't speak the language, where they don't know anyone, there's an immense amount of investment that people have put into building their lives in these communities. And I think that labor of love is like so ignored in a lot of these conversations that we get in mainstream media.
the government says they will rehouse people. They say it's about better living conditions. But when you look closely, something else becomes clear. This is the same logic as Operation Molto, the same logic as the lockdown. When the state wants to control a community it doesn't understand, it contains it. When containment produces resistance, it disperses it.
What is the intersection between anti-police work and government housing advocacy work?
I mean, there's a huge crossover. I think it's the same, right? I think it's fundamentally the same. So growing up in public housing, it felt like when we called police, they never rocked up, or when we needed them, they were never there. But they were always a figure. They're a character in public housing. Like, if you live in public housing, you know, there's like that. The neighbor who's like, you know, asking you over for a cup of tea. The little kid who's like screaming their head off, running up in the corridor. And then there's like the police. You know, like, they're a character. There's so much of Australian society that doesn't see police. Like, police are invisible.
Yeah.
Like, you know, police are invisible for them. They don't see them. They're not a figure in, they're not a character in their lives.
Yeah.
In public housing, they're a character in your lives. Like, And I think the relationship between police and public housing is unique. They're mostly migrant communities, newly arrived migrant communities, or communities that have been entrenched into public housing and into that style. And police see them as inherently suspicious. Like, it doesn't matter who lives there. It's like, just living in that area or living in that building, you're inherently already suspicious.
This is Crystal McKinnon, a Yamatji woman, an academic and activist.
I wanted to ask you about the Hail Michael case as the first time the Victoria Police faced a racial profiling lawsuit.
Mm.
What stood out to you about that case, the things that you witnessed of it at the time?
I think it was an incredibly important case to speak to the racism of Victoria Police and policing everywhere, should I say, but in this case, VicPol, and the way that they were targeting communities in and around the Housing Commission flats.
The demolition is dispersal by another name. It's still racialized policing.
And you don't know when. That's the issue.
Yep.
You don't know when you have to do all these things. You just know that it's coming. You can't make a goal. You can't create a timeline. It's just happening, and you have to figure out how to get it done, but not when.
Yeah, and also you have to figure out what kind of, you know, trade-off you're going to make to be able to secure any kind of housing. When you move out, some of the flats have been augmented in the buildings to accommodate larger family sizes. And everything around these buildings is prime real estate. So where's Homes Victoria getting the money to get properties that are in the area to make sure that communities aren't broken up? Like, it's just impossible to see how this decision is going to play out without dispersing communities. And so thinking then about how people will have to restart their whole lives in a place that might not be familiar to them, but most importantly, without that physical proximity to other folks, that there's an interdependence in figuring their lives out in a racist society.
Dispersal isn't an accident of the demolition. It's its purpose. And the state couldn't destroy this community through policing, Operation Molto, or the hard lockdown. Sharandev Singh has watched this dynamic play out for decades.
No, it's in the fibre of those places.
Yeah.
It's in the history and the currency of those places to be both intensely policed from the outside and to be able to deal with issues of care and harm in those very places, you know. And I think that is one of the reasons why they want to knock those flats down. It's only the degradation of the physical space do they achieve the degradation and isolation of communities of resistance and colour.
Yeah, and I think that what happened with hard lockdown was, like, I feel like they wanted to find something out, and they did, and they said, hey, this community is a bit too strong, this community is a bit too well connected, and they're able to resist any sort of thing that we throw at them, so we need to disperse them.
The state used the physical space of the towers to police the community. But the physical space also made resistance possible. The density that made surveillance easy made solidarity easier. The same corridors the police mapped were the corridors where kids played, neighbors folded each other's laundry, and where teenagers were sent to babysit. So why does the state surveil us? Why do they see us as a threat? And most importantly, why do they want to disperse us? Ultimately, they're dispersing us because it's prime real estate. It's the inner city. this area that was seen as like a slum, that was seen as undesirable, when black people made it a home, when it became a cultural hub, it was decided that that wasn't, that they weren't worthy of that inner city location. It became desirable to people who had finances, that had wealth, you know? And even though they wanted the culture of the place, they didn't want the people, you know? And I think that the same thing happened with Carlton. It's like we saw what happened when they were slowly gentrifying it. They started with the walk-ups and then they did the flats, right? Carlton bars that used to have Ramadan soccer, it became like a risk. It wasn't allowed anymore because it didn't serve the community anymore. It served the patrons that lived across the street, because we didn't live across the street anymore. So when I think about what's happening with Flemington and North Melbourne, it was decided that it's not for us anymore. That refugee, black people, people with less money, they don't deserve to live in the inner city. And it's not enough for us not to be living there. It's like, I think, firstly, I felt like we had too much ownership of it. I feel like the way that people who live in Carlton move through Lygon Street, the way that people who live in Flemington and North Melbourne move throughout the whole area, including the CBD, I feel like you have a sense of confidence that you move with. You feel a sense of home. And the multiculturalism that is celebrated is the same multiculturalism that's not desired when people don't desire it for where they want to live. They desire it for where they want to frequent. In the place of public housing, the state is proposing community housing, houses managed by a not-for-profit organisation. More expensive, harder to attain, and less accountability on the organisations. They want us out, policed out, demolished out. The state's logic is clear. Disperse the community, erase the resistance. But it's like Sister Zai said, the community still beats their drum.
And I guess healing is something that has to be sustained and maintained. And it's like, because if you look at any group of people who are Indigenous to anywhere, right? It's not like they just go, oh, now I'm healed, and they go. They always come back and they do like a little ritual, and then there's like a little ceremony, and then, you know? Mm. Like every few months or so, it's like that community needs to keep gathering. Mm. Maybe not for that particular initial purpose, but just to kind of reinforce and to remember.
The record exists because people keep gathering.
If we have more spaces where we can just get together and vibe. Because that's the thing, you're kind of like, Audre Lorde said it, you got to party first. Mm. This is why I'm just like, why are they shutting down our party spaces?
Yeah. No, we actually, yeah.
Because you got to party, because the party and the joy and all of that good feeling lays a very firm foundation for when stuff goes pear.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we want to be together.
Yeah.
When you want to be together, you'll figure it out.
Oh, you want cake? You want cake? Come, let's talk.
Yeah. But it's those communities when people are thrown together and up against each other that, you know, the violence of policing is resisted. You know, the damage of policing is resisted. You see that not just here and in the Koori community where community and mob are completely expendable to police. But you see communities of resistance all over the world. You're talking about Northern Ireland, you're talking about Brazil, you're talking about, you know, the resistance at Grenfell Tower. In the global north, in the global south, you know, place is race and power and resistance. And in those spaces of resistance, the police are ousted. The police are actually... the intention of the police are actually defeated. And in these small, they're not small, they're expansive sites of resistance, there is not the idea of abolitionist spaces, but the practice of abolitionist spaces that has become deeply ingrained. Not talked about, not theorized about, but part of the daily living and the daily imagining of what could be and what is.
I want to say, when I thought about the question, I said if we were to redirect funding away from police, but I'm going to say when we redirect funding away from the police and into community, where would you like to see that money go?
I would love to see that money to go into the hands of communities to make those decisions themselves, to self-determine. I think when you communities self-determine how funds are spent in their community, in programs and service delivery, I think that's where you get the best out of it. And that's what I've seen in my own personal experience. When communities are organising around their own needs, that's where you get the best out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But more broadly, I think, like, it's just not rocket science. Decent housing for everybody, education and health. I mean, wouldn't it be good if our state spent... I mean, how much did they put? They nearly put $1 billion into prisons in this budget. It's outrageous. And I don't know the latest figures, but... I do remember when I was like a couple of years ago looking at how much they put into housing and then comparing that to how much they put into prisons, and the difference was like mind-blowing. Mm. That how much they're investing into prison. It's like $100,000 to keep a person in prison.
Yeah.
A year. I mean, that's so much money.
Yeah.
You can just give people that kind of money on the street to organise themselves, you know, and to look after themselves. But there's an industry that needs to be kept alive. I think while we're talking about that, that also leads into how Victoria relies on prisons for industry as well, and economics, which is another added layer that, you know, our people, all people in Victoria are up against. That's capitalism. So that, yeah, education, health and housing, I could, you know.
Yeah.
Basic.
This was always about policing. This was always about controlling who gets to belong in the city. And when control fails, removal begins. The way I see it, the announcement to demolish is just one big move along order. A reality Musab knows far too well. Growing up in Richmond, he lives the current iteration of being policed as a young black man in public housing. I asked him to imagine what our community safe and joyful would look like.
Like, you go downstairs, what's happening?
I'm gonna see everyone outside.
Everyone's outside, what are they doing?
I'm gonna see the barbecues that we used to have back in the day.
Yeah.
You're gonna see the aunties outside, the kids outside.
What are the aunties drinking?
God knows, varies from tea to coffee to
Vaughn,
water sometime, maybe cordial. The soft drinks, the 24 packs they bring to the parks. Yeah.
What are the kids doing?
You got a kid crying in the corner because he fell. He tripped over. You got other kids running, playing tag. Got the older kids telling the younger kids to get away because this is the older kid's side and this is the younger kid's side. You know, just...
What are the older kids doing on their side in their little... At the tables? Some of them sitting on the tables, some of them sitting on the chairs. What are they talking about?
Probably nothing. They're just doing a whole bunch of nonsense.
Yeah.
Sitting down, just talking about random stuff.
Yeah.
Telling the kids to get away every 5 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
Eating.
Yeah.
100% eating.
Mm-hmm.
Put them on their phones, doing whatever. If not, then...
Playing songs.
Yeah. Maybe a tournament, they're playing basketball or soccer.
Yeah.
You know? That's the ideal way that we want to see the community, you know?
Love to see it. Thank you so much.
Inshallah.
Here is what the state wanted. For you not to know our names. For the field contact data to disappear, for the settlement to be signed in silence, for the lockdown to be remembered as a public health measure, for the towers to come down and for us to scatter, and for the next generation to have no record of what this community built here, what it survived here, and what it refused here. But the flats are still standing. People are waking up in them this morning, getting their kids ready for school, making ajera, watching down from their window as they heat their hands. The people who grew up in these buildings are still here, still connected, still watching, still organizing. This record is to remember our movement so that we can keep building from where we've left off. This is just a fragment of our past and it pales in comparison to our future. This is the People's Record.
The People's Record was hosted by Udo Ali, produced by Ila Diaz and Lucy Griffin. Music by Pip Norman. edited and mixed by Andrew Futanen-McEwen. Art design by Peter Morgan. The voices in the series are Reem, Daniel Hellmichael, Tamar Hopkins, Sister Zizander, Hilo Diaz, Priya Kunjan, Mariki Onus, Crystal McKinnon, Sharon Dev Singh, Ahmed, and Musa. This series was made on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who have never ceded sovereignty. The People's Records thanks the Community Broadcast Fund, 3CR, and Humdinger Studios for their generous support.